I'm hoping that we'll be able to have a conversation after our former presentations about some of the kind of the organizing work that is ongoing in New York City's Chinatowns, which are Sunset Park, Manhattan, Chinatown, and Flushing. Sunset Park in Brooklyn, Flushing in Queens, and Manhattan, Chinatown. I'm really happy to be here presenting on an article that I co-authored with Sam. This isn't our first collaborative effort. We've also collaborated on some other work on Flushing, right, and the developments that are happening in downtown Flushing, which are putting tremendous kind of pressures on the existing affordable housing stock in the neighborhood, which is largely rent-stabilized housing stock. So this collaboration is special in a couple of different ways. The primary way is that we understood that the Asian American Matters, the volume of the CUNY Forum, which our article is published in, was an issue to honor our former colleague, friend, and mentor, Peter Kwong. And Peter passed away about a little over a year ago, very untimely death. But the work that we're presenting today, I think it builds on a lot of his theorizing and his kind of community-based and community-engaged research. For example, I think that it was Peter's work that first, as an undergraduate, that I read in the New Chinatown that really talked about class differences among the Chinese immigrant community. And this was really, you know, important for me because nowhere before had I really read about the experiences of my own family who were immigrants, but we were not kind of model Asian American model minorities because, in fact, they were laborers and in fairly exploited conditions in the garment industry as well as in industrial laundry. And certainly, so Peter's work really focused on those class divisions and really kind of very critically examine the myth of ethnic economies and this notion of bonded solidarity that because of a shared ethnicity that employers and laborers and workers necessarily will share kind of similar goals and interests, et cetera. The other thing that Peter worked on was really to talk about growing undocumented population within the Asian American community that really also deepened this crisis of kind of, you know, inequality and class divide. He also worked on kind of studying the importance of more grassroots worker-based organizations that are tied more deeply to the community. And this was work that was really important because the union movement, the American labor movement, had really failed to organize effectively a lot of the immigrant workers, you know, in these neighborhoods, and also in immigrant-dominated niches. So, and then finally, his work more recently in the last couple of years really turned to look at the question and the impact of gentrification, and in particular the gentrification of Manhattan Chinatown, with a focus on the role of community elites and their complicity in kind of facilitating gentrification. So so our work, this paper, starts with the understanding that New York City's Chinatown continues to be central in shaping the socioeconomic and the incorporation trajectories and experiences of Chinese immigrants. But like many New York City neighborhoods, they're faced with challenges, namely that of gentrification, as a result of this market-driven real estate development and the influx of development finance some of it increasingly transnational finance. So our paper looks at the nature of work and the changing composition of the local neighborhood economies of New York City's Chinatowns. We look at it in terms of primarily industry, in terms of the kinds of firms that are in these neighborhoods and the number of jobs and type of jobs. So let's see, where am I going now? Okay, so I think that, so I'm going to present some of the data, but before that, I think Sam is going to elaborate on our theoretical framing of the article, which basically finds that these neighborhoods were once sites of manufacturing, kind of labor-intensive, kind of dense manufacturing firms, but now increasingly are sites of real estate capital and real estate development, with the consequences of, again, this deepening inequality among the nature of work and employment opportunities in these neighborhoods.
So, as Tori said, I'm going to give a little bit of the theoretical overview that framed this paper. And it came out of really like a year's worth of conversations between us about what was going on in all these different neighborhoods, starting with the premise that all three of the major Chinese New York City neighborhoods are experiencing some form of gentrification, which in each three places includes rising rents, tenant displacement, luxury development, street life disciplining, and the replacement of family businesses and affordable services with boutiques and big chains. And so we looked at that, thinking about these three neighborhoods not as somehow peripheral to what's going on in the rest of the city, the rest of the country, or the rest of the world, but really central to understanding global processes of labor and capital restructuring in the 21st century. And any kind of major restructuring, like the simultaneous gentrification of all three of the major Chinese neighborhoods in New York, is going to be linked to some sort of crisis. And usually when you look at a transformation that big, you can connect it. And thinking about that, there's really two of them, the first being 9/11 and the second being the 2008 mortgage crisis that happened in the first decade of the 20th century and set up what happens later on politically and economically in these neighborhoods. And we should note that the epicenter of both those crises was blocks away from Manhattan's Chinatown, in the World Trade Center and in Wall Street. These places where sort of everything changed from that moment on were right there in lower Manhattan. And so we look, Tari will talk a little bit more about our methodology in tracking this through work, but we looked at the conditions right before 9/11 and then a few years after that crisis to see how things had changed. And in taking it as a whole, we kind of came up with this one mega sentence of a theoretical statement. I'm going to read it and then break it out. So the sentence is, which is kind of like our theoretical thesis statement, whereas historically U.S. Chinatowns were developed as strategies to absorb Chinese surplus workers and provide for their social reproduction in a manner that generally benefited U.S. manufacturing capital, today these neighborhoods are being reshaped as strategies to absorb Chinese surplus capital and provide lucrative investment opportunities for transnational capitalists in a manner that largely benefits U.S. real estate capital, including locally based immigrant growth coalitions. That's a lot in there. Mm-hmm. So starting with the first part of it, historically, U.S. Chinatowns were developed as strategies to absorb Chinese surplus workers. Surplus workers meaning those who are unemployed, who are no longer necessary for the economic model in China. Workers that were made surplus in China have historically been pushed out to many different places around the world, including the U.S. and in New York, that was sort of ghettoized into Chinatown in the 19th century. So U.S. Chinatowns, including thus the ones in New York, was made to absorb that, those workers and provide for their social reproduction. Social reproduction meaning what it takes to stay alive, what it takes to literally reproduce the worker. So the worker produces the goods. What does it take to produce the worker? It takes food, it takes housing, it takes social networks, it takes healthcare, all that stuff. So the Chinatowns could absorb Chinese surplus workers, provide for their social reproduction, but it wasn't just, you know, happy for everybody. It was in a way that generally benefited U.S. manufacturing capital, which in New York City, starting especially in the 60s and 70s, was the garment industry. But even before that was other forms of manufacturing that was going on in New York City's Chinatown. So that's the historical model. Today we're saying these neighborhoods are being reshaped as strategies to absorb Chinese surplus capital. Surplus capital meaning profit. So all this profit that's being created very quickly in China through their rapid urbanization, through their industrialization, needs to go somewhere. And a lot of it is reinvested in mainland China. The vast majority of it is. But both because not all of it can be absorbed in China, and also as a way of sort of hedging your bets. If you made a lot of money in China, you want to spread it out. It's now being absorbed in U.S. Chinatowns as an investment opportunity that largely benefits U.S. real estate capital. Developers, landlords, those who own and profit off of land, rentiers in the classical language. And that's not just sort of like people out there. It's also very much local immigrant growth coalitions, which is language that Tari Hum developed to describe the groups of people who come together in an immigrant neighborhood to profit off of growth. Similar to the way that Logan and Mollich talk about growth machines in the city as a whole, this is specifically the immigrant growth machines that have arisen in places like Chinatowns. So now that I've explained it, I'll read it again. Whereas historically, U.S. Chinatowns were developed as strategies to absorb Chinese surplus workers and provide for their social reproduction in a manner that generally benefited U.S. manufacturing capital, today these neighborhoods are being reshaped as strategies to absorb Chinese surplus capital and provide lucrative investment opportunities for transnational capitalists in a manner that largely benefits U.S. real estate capital, including locally based immigrant growth coalitions. So that's what we're trying to say. And we take the sort of unusual approach of focusing not just on rents and property development, though we also talk a lot about that, and I in particular do, but we're looking at how it changes work, where people are working, how much they're making, what industries they're working in. So now I'll pass it back to Tari to talk about our methodology.
Great. I think that, you know, as you were explaining the theoretical framework, I immediately can think of different examples that exemplify that, and maybe we'll get to it. But you're right. In this paper we focused on the nature of work, and to just show that shift from manufacturing to more service, to more finance-related jobs in these neighborhoods. But certainly in our kind of analysis or discussion of the politics of these neighborhoods, we can certainly bring in back the more the development, you know, aspects of this. So, okay. So because I know it's a Friday evening, it's getting late, I know we had a long week, and unfortunately I'm going to have a bunch of dense tables that I hope that I'll be able to kind of point out the key things that I want to show. But it's important, I think, for a variety of reasons to be able to kind of provide some empirical evidence for the things that we're seeing happen, in our daily interactions with the community and whatnot. So So for this paper, we used two different kinds of official data. One is demographic data, and the data is from the census as well as from the American Community Survey. Again, we picked the year 2000 because it's to look at the post 9/11 impacts on the economy. And then we picked the later date to kind of look at post 2008 financial crisis. So the closest I could get to the 2015 data of the quarterly census is the 2016 five-year estimates for the American Community Survey. Now both those, the data that, the demographic data, they're about the people that live in these neighborhoods. Okay, so the data is going to be about the residents of these particular neighborhood spaces. They're also sample data. And, of course, you know, data has a lot of shortcomings. And certainly, you know, having the undercount, the census undercount, would kind of impact the reliability of the data. But it's the best that we have. The industry data is about the firms and the businesses and the types of jobs and workers and wages in a particular neighborhood space. So it's not about the people that live there. The people that hold those jobs could, in fact, live in other parts of the city. So that's just an important thing to differentiate. But I'm hoping that by using these two data sources that we can kind of get at a more comprehensive understanding of the neighborhood economy. So, and we look at 2000, we use 2000 and 2015 quarterly census of employment and wages, which is collected by the Department of Labor. And this is not sample data, but it also is subject to an undercount because it only captures those firms that participate or pay into the New York State Unemployment Insurance Program. So we know that a lot of firms, particularly in, you know, these immigrant economies, are part of the informal economy and don't pay into the unemployment insurance. So it's going to be an undercount in that respect. But common to our analysis of these two data, of these demographic and industry data, is that we use the same geographic definitions for each of the neighborhoods. So for Manhattan, Chinatown, we're looking at zip codes, you know, 1002 and 10013. For Sunset Park, it's 1220 and 11232, and then for Flushing it's 11354 and 11355. And I think that most planners or activists or residents will agree that these are zip codes that approximate the boundaries of the neighborhood. So the first thing that I just want to show, this is based on the 2016 American Community Survey data. And it's basically a demographic composition by race of New York City's Chinatowns. And the thing that I want to point out is that, and this is why Chinatowns is kind of in quotes, because these are Chinatowns, but they're multiracial neighborhoods. And for Manhattan Chinatown, unfortunately, by 2016, or this actually happened a couple years ago, the Asian population has fallen below half. Okay, so Asians are now 40% of the population of Manhattan Chinatown, and it is largely predominantly Chinese. And then 21% is Latino, and 29% are non-Hispanic whites. In Sunset Park, 36% Asian. I've seen other years of the American Community Survey that actually puts it up at 38%, but it's around there. Clearly, it's not the majority racial group is the key point. Latinos continue to be the majority racial group in Sunset Park. And in Sunset Park, the Latino population is very diverse. Historically Puerto Rican and then Dominican, but increasingly Mexican. And I think that Mexicans actually are the largest Latino group in Sunset Park, again underscoring that it's a very heavily immigrant neighborhood. Flushing, Queens is the only one of New York City's Chinatowns that now has a majority Asian population. It is majority Chinese, although there's also a very sizable Korean population as well as a South Asian population. Okay. So this is where we look at some of the data from the quarterly census. So I'm looking at the year 2000, and I'm looking at the year 2015, and I identify the number of firms, the employees, and the top sectors. Now, the thing about Manhattan Chinatown that's really interesting is that there are only four industry sectors that constitutes the majority of the types of jobs for this neighborhood. Four industry sectors. Okay, that's one thing. The other thing, and then I'll go over what that is. And the other thing is that I actually separate, for the case of Chinatown, I separate the zip code 10002 with 10013 because it's clear that by the year 2015 that really 10013 is not really a part of Chinatown's, you know, local economy anymore, primarily because of the demise of the apparel industry in that zip code and the fact that it's clear that the firms and the jobs that are being created in the Tribeca Soho zip code are much more closely integrated with Wall Street than they are with Manhattan Chinatown. So Manhattan Chinatown is, in fact, shrinking in terms of its immigrant ethnic economy and becoming much more concentrated in the zip code 10012. And you can see that, let's see, in terms of 10013 in the year 2000, it's pretty surprising, but as late as 2000, the largest employment sector in that zip code in Tribeca and Soho was apparel manufacturing, with nearly 9,000 workers and almost 300 firms. By the year 2015, that is certainly not the case, and there's an increasing bifurcation among the top four sectors in which you can see that those that work in professional, scientific and technical services and securities and commodities contracts, their average wages are six figures compared to the other top sectors, which are food services and drinking places and ambulatory healthcare services, which includes home health aides as well as doctor's offices. So I think that's the key story here in Manhattan Chinatown. I should also know, I think it does say here that all of the wages in 2000 are reflected in 2015 dollars. And 10002 remains the sectors remain kind of consistent with an immigrant economy that is primarily centered around food, services and restaurants, and retail. This is actually this is an article about immigrant food cyclists, and in this case, it's an article that's focused on Chinese immigrant food delivery cyclists, which I would imagine, which is an important source of employment for these men, who are largely, older immigrant men who don't have language ability. I would imagine if we had immigrated at this point rather than when we did in the 70s, my dad might have had to work as a immigrant food delivery cyclist. But this is a colleague of ours who is a PhD in environmental psychology at the Graduate Center is actually writing his dissertation on the experiences of these immigrant food cyclists who depend on they're called pedal assist bicycles, because a lot of their wages, it's based on how fast they can deliver the food. And so it's just, again, a more contemporary form of the very labor-intensive type niches that most Chinese immigrants, were concentrated in. Maybe not in manufacturing any longer, but certainly, there are other service-type niches in which that same kind of piece rate work it requires tremendous labor effort. Thing is about here is that even though these pedal assist bicycles help these workers actually be able to kind of cobble together enough tips to support themselves and their family, the e-bikes are of great controversy. And Mayor de Blasio has said that the state has banned electronic bicycles, and that these food cyclists, you know, should get into cars, or they should deliver their food on foot, or there's other different strategies. So we included that as just kind of an example of the kinds of, you know, jobs that exist now for these workers that are in the service sector.
Yeah, and I'm smiling right now because I just had a memory of Peter Kwong getting really mad about electric bicycles and having to be talked down by Wing Lam, who was saying, no, you're misunderstanding this. This isn't a transportation issue. This is a labor issue. And he came around on that issue. So glad he got a chance to come around. I want to add some specific cases around buildings in Chinatown and show how this transformation affected them as the garment sector leaves Manhattan's Chinatown in such a dramatic fashion, as we just saw from those charts. That's a lot of open space, and it's a lot of real estate that then gets very quickly adapted. And so, as some folks know, in the last couple of years of his life, Peter Kwong and I were trying to put together a book about gentrification in Chinatown, and I wrote a section about the transformation of buildings from industrial and manufacturing uses to residential real estate. And I just want to read a bit of that to add some specific cases to the general picture. On Chinatown's east side, which would be that 10002 zip code, stands 175 East Broadway, a New York City landmark known to many as the Forward Building. Looking out over what is now Seward Park, the ornate 10-story Beaux-Arts building was constructed in 1912 as the home of the Jewish daily Forward, a left-wing Yiddish newspaper. The building's most distinctive feature is a row of four busts serving as radical gargoyles to watch over the building: Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Ferdinand LaSalle, and Carl Liebknecht. Over the years, as Jews left the Lower East Side, stopped speaking Yiddish as a native language, and in many cases shunned the radicalism that the newspaper represented, the Forward fell on hard times. In 1972, the paper moved out, and in recognition of the neighborhood's changing demographics, they sold the building to the Chinese Alliance Church for $99,000. The church used the space as a chapel as well as a Chinese language Bible warehouse. About a decade later, they sold the building to a Chinatown businessman and real estate operator named Mui Hu Lau for $316,000. Shortly thereafter, in 1986, the city declared 175 East Broadway a landmark, curtailing changes to the exterior of the building. Over the next two decades, the Lau family put about $10 million into renovating the building's interior, creating spaces for 29 condominiums. They sold the building in 2005, right between our two crises, to Ronald Castellano and Christopher Hayes, a pair of developers and architects active in the Lower East Side, for $23.5 million. That group managed to squeeze an additional 10 apartments into the building and put the 39 condominiums onto the market. Apartments have listed for as high as $4.5 million. Sublets have gone for $15,000 a month. Meanwhile, the stone faces of Marx and Engels still hang above the entrance, an unintentionally ironic reminder of the contradictions between the building's past and present. On Chinatown's west side, that 10013 zip code, the building stock is very similar to that of neighboring Soho and Tribeca, featuring fewer tenements and more commercial lofts. Developers who noted the outstanding success of those neighborhoods' commercial to residential conversions hope that the same can be done in Chinatown. That same 2005, an international real estate outfit called Tri-Beach Holdings completed a long renovation at 129 Lafayette, turning the 12-story light brick building into luxury condominiums. The following year, Tri-Beach's William Fagan told the New York Times, "It used to be that Little Italy felt threatened by Chinatown, but now Soho is pushing over and Chinatown is receding and feeling threatened. The whole corridor is getting gentrified." This is the developer. He's saying that that's a good thing. The Times reported that, quote, the building attracted photographers and designers, investment bankers, and a few Chinatown professionals, unquote. Most famously, the building has become home to pop singer Rihanna, who pays $39,000 a month to rent the penthouse. None of this, however, would have been possible without the permission of the city of New York. Because of the zoning on this particular block, the developers needed a variance to allow them to close their functional gap, which is the gap between how much you can make from an industrial building and how much you can make from a residential building, close the functional gap, and convert the building from industrial to residential. Not leaving anything to chance, Tri-Beach hired a veteran lobbyist, Howard Hornstein of the firm Fishbein, Badillo, Wagner, and Harding, to shepherd the building through the city's complex and potentially contentious public review process. After 3 years of work, however, the developer got the permit and the conversion came to pass. 129 Lafayette is not alone. A few blocks south, in what real estate agents are trying desperately to label Tribeca, several similar conversions have taken place. At 93 Worth, the Izaki Investment Group turned an 18-story manufacturing building into 92 lofts, residential lofts, featuring not only a roof deck terrace, but a dog washing station as well. Sales prices are rising rapidly. In 2010, they averaged $300 per square foot, but by 2013, prices were up to $550 per foot. One block south at 9 Murray Street, after a similar conversion, penthouse square footage now sells for $2,700 per square foot. While garment factory conversions have been the most common form of loft housing production in Chinatown, developers stuck with a finite set of convertible spaces are looking increasingly to less traditional spaces for housing possibilities. In 2006, Alex Abrams' AS Realty Partners turned a former police stable at 209 Hester into 14 luxury condominiums. A few blocks south, 371 Madison Street has been transformed from a shuttered public school into a baffling experiment in design. The partners behind the project represented the constituents they hoped to attract. Developer Thomas Sung is the founder of Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a major Chinese-American lender. And broker Michael Bola is the New York City real estate magnate and Jewish philanthropist representing multiple projects on the Lower East Side, including the Forward Building. Together, they're pitching 371 Madison towards wealthy Chinese and Jewish households, and they're sparing no expense. When they opened the building to potential buyers, one prominent real estate blog titled their review, "Manhattan's Weirdest Condo Hosts Totally Weird Showhouse." Several apartments were done up in various styles by professional designers to show off the building's possibility. One such model apartment, labeled The Future, was described as such in the developer's press release. The future experience, a stark world of contrasting white and black with pops of color, starts by stepping into an outer space environment created by Mexican artist Pablo Alessandro, accentuated with digital Jenny Holzer artwork, DB King Unity Ring chandeliers, a dramatic Antonio Saracino raised sofa, and a galactic video by James Weingarad. Ironically, I went to high school with that guy. With 17-foot ceilings, the massive Cecil Balmud virtual world projections dominate the main room. Thomas Heatherwick's glistening extrusion bench is tucked away with Aranda Lash, modern primitive lounge chairs, nesting sofas, one black rubber by Max Lamb and the other stark white by Ramon Esteve, balanced by an iconic Piero Lissoni coffee table. Just to the side, Beck Breton's dramatic chandelier hangs over a fossil table by Andrew Yes, accessorized with dinosaur-designed resin tableware. Upstairs, Pryor Calloway presents an almost virtual bedroom of the future, which makes you wonder if sleep will even be necessary. Mm-hmm. So that's how they're describing their Chinatown conversion. In addition to frighteningly postmodern design possibilities, the buildings offer an array of unlikely amenities, including kosher, vegan, organic room service, organic laundry, a yoga studio, a heated indoor saltwater pool with single-sex hours for Orthodox Jews, in-house nutritional therapy, and cranial sacral therapy as well. Perhaps 371 Madison, with its avant-garde pretensions, went over the top. Shortly after the building opened, sales were shut down, and management hinted that it might convert the condominiums into rentals, with rents set to start around $3,000 a month. But the fact that a building like this would even open in Chinatown suggests that real estate capital has already settled on this neighborhood as Manhattan's next loft district. Nearby Soho and Tribeca served as models, proving in the 1970s and 80s that this kind of transition could be accomplished in full and developing an aesthetic that could be replicated and sold elsewhere. In those neighborhoods, the gentrification was relatively slow and experimental. There was no playbook for loft conversions. With the business model now established, Chinatown developers can summon massive investments and turn out lofts with remarkable speed. So those are some examples of how this transformation has taken place in Manhattan's Chinatown. And I just want to highlight a few different public policies that help speed this process along. The first is zoning. So we heard about these spot rezonings that have taken place that have allowed some of these transformations, because if the area is actually zoned for manufacturing, the city needs to allow it to convert to residential unless there's some sort of an overlay district. But there were also a couple other rezonings, which probably many people in the room know about, so I'm not going to spend too much time on. But in 2008, the Bloomberg administration rezoned a large swath of the East Village and the Lower East Side. And if you know your community districts, Chinatown is mostly in that same district. It's also in neighboring districts, but a large portion of it is in Community District 3, along with the East Village and the Lower East Side. This rezoning did a lot of different things, but on the whole, it was a contextual rezoning. So it protected the neighborhood from new development, from new hotels, stuff like that. And if you look at the blocks that were protected versus the blocks that were left out of the rezoning, it was the wealthiest and whitest blocks in this community district that were protected. Meanwhile, most of Chinatown and the poorest parts of the Lower East Side were left out. So if you think of this as the choices where future development is going to happen, which is the closest thing to planning that our city does, we tell developers what they can do. This was telling developers, if you want to build big hotels, big luxury condos, you're going to have to do it in Chinatown and the poorer parts of the Lower East Side. You're not going to do it in the East Village, except on a couple very specific corridors. So that you can think of as displacing displacement pressure from the East Village onto Chinatown. There was also a rezoning in 2011 of the Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. That's a long and complicated history that I'd be happy to go into in the Q&A, but the important part of it is that it was public land. And it was public land that was cleared of working class tenants about 45, almost 50 years ago, and was mostly not rebuilt. So a lot of people got displaced. Very few people moved onto the site. It was mostly parking lots for about 40 years. When the city finally put in a bid to redevelop it, they did it in their sort of classic model at the time, which was for private developers to build a lot of luxury housing, which would cross-subsidize some affordable housing. So it's not that there's no affordable housing in this site, but the point is that it's public land and that it was only working class people who were displaced in the first place. So it was an opportunity to do something different that wasn't taken. And the redevelopment of that area as this private, semi-affordable, largely luxury model has changed the real estate economics of the whole area around it. The other piece of public policy to mention is business improvement districts, which are private organizations, but they're enabled by the city through the Small Business Administration. And there's been multiple attempts to put a bid in Chinatown. There was one in the 70s before bids were even a thing, when they called it a special assessment district, but it failed. Neighborhood merchants were not interested in this. They saw it as an extra cost burden that wouldn't bring them services that the city shouldn't have been providing already. Tried it again in the 80s, again it failed. Tried again in 2002, and again it failed. Post 9/11 kind of created the opportunities for another push. There was new money that came in through the Lower Manhattan Development Council, but also through Sheldon Silver channeling money from the Assembly that was put toward a private street cleaning service that was cleaning up the streets after 9/11 in Chinatown, which is a really important service that the city should have been doing, but they sort of stepped in and did it on top. Then that money was only there for 3 years, so it was about to go away, and suddenly there needed to be somebody to step in and replace them. The Chinatown Partnership, which had been founded in this moment of crisis, stepped in and said, we'll set up a business improvement district. That was a highly contentious fight. A lot of businesses opposed it. A lot of tenant groups opposed it, seeing it as something that would eventually raise their rents and displace them, and as an extra tax that really would only duplicate the services that the city was supposed to be doing with their tax money. It was the closest bid vote of any business improvement district in the city, the Chinatown vote. But the bid won, so it is a fact. There's been attempts now to decommission it, which would take a lot of signatures from business and property owners. Ultimately, however, the city council member is the one who would have to shepherd that, and the city council member is very pro-business improvement district. But that business improvement district is part of the strategy of transforming the nature of work in Chinatown, especially towards tourist uses. Part of the idea of the bid is that it's going to be there to help make the neighborhood friendlier to tourists, and that's been a lot of the public messaging that they've done, is make the neighborhood a place where tourists will come and spend money, which of course is an economic development model, but it's a very different one than the one we were talking about earlier in terms of labor-intensive work that would employ a whole lot of people. Tourism simply doesn't do that. So with that, I'm going to pass it back to Tari, who's going to talk about Sunset Park.
A couple things about Sunset Park. Sunset Park is now the city's last largest concentrated urban industrial infrastructure neighborhood. There are several complexes along the waterfront, including Industry City, which is, I think, about 6 million square feet of space in 16 huge factory loft buildings along the waterfront. The next largest landlord, property owner in Sunset Park is the city. The New York City Economic Development Corporation, they own Bush Terminals. They also own the Brooklyn Army Terminal. And I think that the total square footage of those two complexes approximate the 6 million square feet that Industry City owns. So at one point in 2000, again, even as late as 2000, you know, the garment manufacturing industry, largely through the labor of, you know, immigrant women, largely Chinese, but also including Latinas, really supported that, that garment industry. But now we see that by 2015, hospitals and healthcare-related industry sectors are the largest employers in Sunset Park. And, of course, an example of that is the Lutheran Medical Center, which is also on the waterfront. In fact, they received a special rezoning in order to actually house a hospital in a manufacturing zone. And much of Sunset Park's waterfront was zoned for heavy manufacturing, which are the most noxious uses. But through some deals and arrangements, it was rezoned so that they could actually develop a hospital there. They proceeded to have the neighborhood designated in the late 1960s as a federal poverty area in order to benefit from federal resources for kind of more community-based medical health provision and proactive medical services. They recently were acquired by the New York University Langone Medical Center. So now that model of more community-based health provision is probably not going to be the model that NYU is going to, promote for that neighborhood. Now, in addition, I mean, we can see that ambulatory healthcare services, that industry category includes home health aides. And in fact, that's a very large, growing sector in Sunset Park. The wages are, not as high as if you worked in the hospital, but that is one of the largest growing sectors. The other thing is that I wanted to point out before I get to talk more about Industry City in terms of how their rezoning proposal potentially will basically decimate the kind of working class industrial waterfront that currently exists in Sunset Park. I just wanted to also point out that Sunset Park had the smallest amount of job growth among the three Chinatowns, even though I think that it's seen as a neighborhood. I mean, the mayor announced his Jobs for New Yorkers task force in front of the Brooklyn Army Terminal, and he really sees this kind of underutilized space as a job growth machine for New York City and for the neighborhood, and in particular creating these middle class jobs that pay $50,000 or more. But we don't really see evidence of that yet, or we might not see it at all. But in any case, the other thing that I wanted to point out is that earnings in typical immigrant-type industry niches like grocery stores and food services and drinking place, the wages between 2000 and 2015, they either stagnated or they declined in real dollars. And those are jobs that are most likely held by immigrant workers. So in 2013, I think some of you might know that Jamestown Properties acquired a majority ownership share of Industry City. They have a vision of renovating and expanding and promoting the growth of an innovation economy. This is how they're defining kind of advanced manufacturing, but these are all jobs that are based on design, based on the maker movements, which are not exactly kind of the manufacturing or jobs that would be available or accessible to the residents of Sunset Park. They're also proposing in their rezoning to build two hotels, as well as expand an academic conference facility. They have submitted in they completed an environmental assessment, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the next step is a draft environmental impact statement. Is that right? But we have Annette. Is it Annette?
Yeah,
from UpRose, and UpRose is an organization, an environmental justice organization that is based in Sunset Park but does work both locally in New York as well as nationally and internationally. In addition to the important work of UpRose, there actually is a journalist, a former journalist, who basically blogs this Sunset Park Reports with a single-minded focus on jobs. Because a lot of ways that the city and other private developers sell development to these communities is that it's going to create jobs. And that it's going. And I think that Industry City has already put it out there that that they're establishing this innovation economy, this innovation hub at Industry City is going to result in 20,000 jobs. And they're claiming that many of those jobs will be available to Sunset Park residents, both in terms of maker jobs, in terms of kind of entry-level computer, high-tech type jobs, et cetera. So this reporter, basically, he has a very single-minded focus with respect to his blog, which is where are the jobs? And to basically, he's been a foil machine. So he has been foiling all of our elected officials who have basically provided funding to community-based organizations that are involved in Industry City's Innovation Lab, which is their workforce development entity. And he hasn't had much success in actually getting documents from, but the fact that he's a pain in these people's side and that these and that they know that someone has a single-minded focus to kind of hold them accountable to what they are claiming is going to be such a benefit to Sunset Park is really important. The other thing, and this is kind of where transnational capital kind of also ties in, with Sunset Park. I mean, there's just so many different ways, but one key way with respect to Industry City is that I wrote an article last year that basically documents how Industry City is being financialized by Chinese transnational capital through huge loans from the Bank of China. So that's definitely one way. The other way is in Sunset Park, Sam had mentioned this idea of immigrant growth coalitions, and also the relationship between kind of surplus labor and capital from China being absorbed in spaces here in the United States, either in the service before of U.S. manufacturers, but now in the service of U.S. developers, is the case of the Brooklyn Friendship Archway up on 8th Avenue. I should have probably included some photographs of it, because there's a very, very powerful photograph of Mayor de Blasio at the site of this proposed traditional archway on October, which was a month before his re-election. And even though there had been no new progress on this proposed archway, he was there surrounded by a lot of the community leaders. They all happened to be Chinese men. So he was surrounded by a group of Chinese men, and Carlos Menchaca and Eric Adams, who is the borough president, and Carlos Menchaca, who is our city council member, to basically, you know, sing the praises of this friendship gate, which was a gift from Beijing. And it's a gift from a district called the Chaoyang District, which is like a neighborhood in Beijing. And that neighborhood also happens to be the site of the Bird's Nest of the 2008 that was constructed for the 2008 Olympics, when China really kind of came on to the world stage. Of course, constructing that infrastructure for the Olympics included a tremendous amount of dispossession and displacement of some of the, you know, the residents in the more traditional houses or the different neighborhoods. So the parallel, it's interesting, is that so Eric Adams, in kind of facilitating this gift, went to China to sign a sister city agreement between Beijing's Chaoyang District and Sunset Park, Brooklyn. And the parallel is that in December of 2017, so just a couple of months ago, Chaoyang District, there was a fire that occurred in a building that had a lot of kind of illegally converted apartment buildings to house the migrant workers. That was a source of affordable housing. This is also something that is very common in Sunset Park, given the rising property values and rents. A lot of people, you know, they cram themselves into single rooms in two-family homes, where the landlords, increasingly now investors who are buying these buildings, are more than happy to subdivide and collect lots of rent. In December 2017, there was a fire. There were 19 people that died, 19 migrant workers who were residents because they were working in Beijing. And the city took it upon, the city basically used that as an excuse to do a mass expulsion of all the migrant workers. That is Sunset Park's sister city. And what is going to happen, you know, the Archway project is being financialized, is being advocated for by a Chinese transnational developer who is going to develop a massive site right next to the N subway station. And this is part of the effort of kind of rebranding that space. But the impact of having that kind of luxury development will have a similar impact in terms of further kind of worsening or creating a housing crisis, worsening the housing crisis, or actually forcing people to leave Sunset Park. So for Flushing, let me see. We know that Flushing is kind of an epicenter, center of Chinese transnational capital. I think that, you know, there's been several stories in the media about the concentration of banks in Flushing, and not only local or U.S.-based ethnic banks, but, you know, large banks. For example, the Industrial Commercial Bank of China is not only the largest bank in China, it is the largest bank in the world in terms of assets, and because it recently acquired Bank of East Asia, which was a U.S.-based subsidiary, but that acquisition required a Federal Reserve decision to approve it. And because of that, now this Industrial Commercial Bank of China, the largest bank in the world, has retail presence in our three Chinatowns. And so so they're there. And and we also know that there is a lot of kind of market-rate luxury condominium development that is occurring. But in terms of when we look at the actual kind of firms that are creating jobs in Flushing, we see a lot of professional jobs. I think that the key thing to know about Flushing is that the professional jobs that the sectors, that their average wages are much lower than if they were professional sectors in the mainstream economy, which just, I think, reinforces that professionals that serve an ethnic community typically will not be earning as much as if they were working in a mainstream economy. You can see that with the average wages of someone in a professional scientific or technical services sector. The other thing that is interesting, that is troubling to know about Flushing, is that in certain sectors that are, you know, very much typical for immigrant neighborhood economies that are concentrated with immigrant workers, the food and drinking places, grocery stores, which also happen to be fairly large sectors in 2015, they pay very low wages. And between 2000 and 2015, just slight increases, right? It didn't, so stagnating. No,
it declined.
Thank you. Okay.
$2,000.
Yes. That's right. Because the average wages in 2000 are in 2015 dollars, so it actually declined and or stagnated for many of the workers. The final thing I would want to also point to is that there's a large personal laundry services sector in Flushing, which really corresponds to nail salons and massage parlors, et cetera, in that neighborhood. So here, I think that this is a very prominent Korean restaurant based in Flushing, Queens, but I think that they have restaurants in other parts of the city, and I think in New Jersey as well. And for many months, a couple of years ago, and was it currently too? I don't remember. But there were the Flushing Workers Center, which is part of the Chinese Staff and Workers Association. They would hold boycotts in front of the restaurants, et cetera, because of the high incidence of wage theft of their workers. And so this was reported in the New York Times a couple of years ago. The other article is actually a press release from the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund with announcing a victory that there's actually going to be an ability to enforce the payment of those owners. Because oftentimes what happens is that if you're a restaurant owner and you're accused of wage theft, you might just kind of close down the restaurant for a couple of months and open under a different name, or you have ways to protect your own individual assets so that, you know, they can't, you're not forced to pay the outstanding wages, you know, through your personal assets. But actually all deaf, and this is a very important victory because these owners will have to pay the workers the wages that they stole from them. So we're not going to do that.
Okay.
We're not. What time is it? Oh, we're definitely not. Yeah.
Can I say one quick thing?
Oh, yes. Yes. I was going to talk about, yes, okay, about the current kind of political situation.
Right. Well,
okay. So, So clearly in Flushing, even though I think that many of us might think of Flushing as kind of a neighborhood that serves a middle class or an affluent middle class Asian American population, there is, and this is research that Sam and I had done, that really there's an affordable housing crisis, and a lot of, you know, working people, working class residents or lower middle class residents of Flushing are at risk of losing their homes. So in 2015, was it 2015 when the mayor introduced this mandatory inclusionary housing? 2016?
Introduced 15, passed 16.
Okay, introduced in 2015. So this was the mayor's housing marketplace. It wasn't called Marketplace. That was Bloomberg.
That was Bloomberg, yeah.
This is just a housing plan, but it was premised on making inclusionary housing not voluntary, but mandatory for any rezoning or upzoning, right, with regard to residential districts, that then the developers were obligated to provide a certain percentage of affordable housing. He identified 15 neighborhoods, and Flushing was one of those neighborhoods. And I think that, and maybe Jack, you might want to chime in, because I think you were involved with some of the meetings. The interesting thing about the Flushing rezoning process, so once the mayor announced that Flushing was one of the 15 neighborhoods, the Department of City Planning began a process of studies, of neighborhood studies, and preparation of an environmental assessment of that impact. But what was interesting is that a couple of years ago, the Flushing Willits Point Corona Local Development Corporation, which was headed up by a former borough president, Claire Schulman, her organization, which the board is largely made up of developers and property owners, as well as some community groups, namely Asian Americans for Equality, they secured a $1.5 million New York State Brownfield Opportunity Area planning grant. It was one of the largest one, if not the largest one, that was given by the Department of State. And that money, a BOA planning grant, is exactly that. It's meant to be it's meant to be used to engage the community at large, to kind of think proactively, develop a vision for the underutilized properties in the area, because these are brownfields. They've been contaminated, or they're perceived as being contaminated, and therefore, developers are loath to kind of develop them or remediate them without kind of some public support or whatnot. UpRose actually also received a grant at about the same time, and UpRose actually, in the spirit of participatory planning, which was what the grant intended to do, developed a study, and I think that study might be part of its current planning for a green industrial waterfront. In any case, in the case of the Flushing Willits Point Corona LDC, they proceeded to do their planning, but it was very much driven by the interests of the private developers who sit on their board. So $1.5 million, and they hired some fairly well-known, reputable planning and engineering firms to conduct some base studies. So in the meantime, the city has started this rezoning study, and there was always kind of a question about who the city was planning for. Was the city engaged in this rezoning study in Flushing for the community at large, or was it really also acting on behalf of the Flushing-Willits Point Corona LDC? Because they basically, the LDC returned $800,000 of the money to the city to basically finish their BOA plan. So now the city is being funded by public money, but public money that a local development corporation that acts on behalf of private developers, and to complete the plan. So, but what happened with the...
Is this cogent?
Yes.
Am I?
Okay. I'm following.
Okay, I hope it's cogent. Okay. So what happened was that the Flushing rezoning process that was led by DCP, ultimately, there was a coalition of community groups called that came under the umbrella of the Flushing Rezoning Community Alliance, and they were advocating on behalf of their constituents, raising questions about how this rezoning plan might accelerate the kind of gentrification that's already happening, how this rezoning plan should, in fact, increase the percentage of affordable housing that is provided if it's implemented, and also to provide more deeper affordability. So there was a public process, and there were many meetings that were held. Then Peter Koo, the city council member, essentially stopped the rezoning process, saying that the city had not addressed all of these other outstanding concerns with regard to infrastructure. The fact that the number 7 subway hub is so congested and so dense because there has not been remediation done along the Flushing Creek, which is connects it to Willits Point. He said for all of these outstanding environmental and infrastructural needs that have not been met, we should stop the rezoning. So that basically stopped a public engagement process because that's where the groups were involved in meetings that were facilitated by DCP. He also noted when he stopped the rezoning that he felt that he was informed by developers who are constituents, that the economics doesn't add up. That given how expensive land is in Flushing, to then expect that these developers provide some social housing, that would cut too much into their profit margin. And that really is true because if you guys, I don't know if you keep tabs on the Flushing real estate market, but there was a large Korean market, Aussie Plaza, that's actually right on the waterfront. And it's actually where I take my students if we want to get close to the river and close to the waterfront.
Not now.
But it was sold. So it was owned by a Maryland-based Korean food distributor. And they sold it to a Chinese developer, a group of Chinese investors, for $55 million. Within a year and a half, without any improvements on that land, the investor owners flipped it for $90-plus million to another group of Chinese investors. Now, you go to that Chinese investor, a group of them, after they purchased this plot of land for over $90 million, and you're telling them, you can't just build a hotel and luxury housing. You're going to have to, build in some affordable housing because that's going to be the zoning rule. That's going to be the regulation. So I think that Peter Koo ultimately capitulated to these private developers. But as a result of that, the public process that was, even if it was a token public process, there was still some opportunity for community groups to advocate and to voice and to participate in this planning process. That ended. Peter Koo basically said, we're not proceeding with this, planning process because the river's not being addressed, because the subway line is too taxed, and there's no infrastructure plan, et cetera. But in the meantime, the city finished the BOA plan that has a rezoning proposal in it. And none of the other provisions that the community groups were pushing for. So that's the story in Flushing.
And to bring together kind of where each neighborhood's story ended, I think, and where our article ends, this transformation of these Chinatown neighborhoods, the change in employment, the change in rents, it produces a different kind of community politics. And so a lot of groups that were set up to do one sort of political mobilization are now doing a different kind, or they're doing both at the same time. So groups that were set up as workers' centers are now also anti-gentrification groups. Groups that were set up as anti-police violence groups are now also anti-gentrification groups. Groups that did economic development are now also anti-gentrification groups. This changes what every community organization has to do in all of these neighborhoods. And the changes that we're talking about are enormous. But that's not to say that they're, you know, therefore going to just keep going the way that they are. There is substantial community opposition that is building up in each of these neighborhoods. So just to end on that note, there are ways to get involved in each of these struggles. The struggles are ongoing. They're not a done deal. And even if these changes seem to be going in this direction, the longer history that you can trace of these neighborhoods is always one of investment and disinvestment and of different flows of labor. None of them have stopped being immigrant neighborhoods. Immigrants continue to come to each of these neighborhoods, continue to work. So even though this talk is now ending, the story continues in ways that we can't necessarily predict.